now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, always been in you. And I am your host, Dr. James Hauck. I just had a thought, I'll put it in the back burner here. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you'd like to leave me your comments about today's shows or other shows, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts are now podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows that you might have missed or something that piques your interest and so forth. Again, you just go to the website and you'll just click on where it says archives, and you will be able to find past shows. And again, I just wanted to thank everybody for their support over the past year and then some. And I just like to say that you now all have an opportunity to continue your support by becoming a monthly subscriber. Now, just a word about that. A subscription is not required to listen to any of my talk shows, but it is greatly appreciated. So again, just invite you to visit that website and click on the link and just choose any amount that you feel comfortable giving. Well, I am very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And each and every week I come, and these broadcasts are focused on dedicating to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And it is very much just a wonderful dedication that I and an emphasis that I put on our spirituality and our mental health. And if you would like to call in and be part of the show, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break, about halfway through the show. So for anybody who is tuning in for the very first time, I just wanted to say welcome. Thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. And just in case you're wondering what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about, just need to say this, because I still get people that come up to me and just say, hey, I listened to the show, or, you know, I read your book on Reclaiming Authenticity and still not quite sure what it's about. But in this context, in this show, Reclaiming Authenticity really focuses on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And I place it all within the context of our relationships. Relationships that we have with ourselves, the relationships that we are in with one another, and certainly our relationship with God or the divine. And for those who are new to the program, again, if this is your first time listening, thank you. I would like to say that I am really a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of, let's say, our giftedness. You know, the skills and the talents and the strengths and the character traits, personality, and so forth. And yet, it's unfortunate because as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel like we need to hide our giftedness, or we want to push those skills way down so that others cannot see, or perhaps we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. And as a result, we stop looking at ourselves as somebody special. We stop considering the fact that what we have to say is worthwhile, or we stop believing that there is any good to be found in us, no matter where we look. But at any rate, whenever we do those things, and whenever we do not realize our giftedness, and we often go through life, you know, functioning from a place of woundedness or victimization, and then we wonder why we're not happy, or why we're frustrated, or why, you know, there are certain patterns in our lives, and the same old lessons keep coming around and around again and again, as if we cannot get out from under that. But whatever, we are able to discover the very best things about ourselves. We realize, one, that there's a lot more where that came from, you know, because we are just scratching the surface whenever we discover something new about ourselves or uniqueness. But two is that we often realize that we can find healing in and through our relationships. And, you know, we approach life then not from that place of woundedness or victimization, but instead we can approach life from that place of healing or wholeness and embracing our uniqueness or our hachetas. And the whole reason why I, you know, place this integration of mental health and spirituality in the greater context of relationships is because when we think about it, we often still, you know, as long as like since the dawn of time, for as long as that, we still often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in relationships. I mean, we are social beings, and it's I'm not going to say it's inevitable that we're going to be wounded, but it happens within the context of relationships that we can receive our deepest wounds. And yet the irony of all this is that we can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. Okay, and these relationships could just be, you know, right as we find them within our own families, or even our colleagues, coworkers, friends, and so forth. But when we're able to discover the very best parts of ourselves and we're able to heal, we find this wonderful transformation is taking place. And that transformation, again, is not just for ourselves. It's also for others, because whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence and our grace and our understanding. But first, forgiveness and kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we are more compassionate with ourselves, we can certainly then become more compassionate with others. And when we are more forgiving with ourselves, we can then certainly be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So transformation, first and foremost, always begins with us. Well, as I always ask this question, I'll ask it again today, how is your heart? I hope it is well. I hope you are well. And I pray that if you are struggling today, you will find the rest and comfort and the peace that you need at exactly the right time you need it. Well, everybody, welcome to the month of August. Here we are. It is August the 6th. And again, I was telling others that I have talked to earlier this week that I don't know what happened to July. It just seemed to fly by. But, you know, just 1 minute it was here and then all of a sudden we're in August. And I remember, you know, celebrating the 4th of July. And, you know, wonderful time, picnic, friends, and all that. But I can't remember anything else. You know, I know that I was involved in doing other things in July. I just can't remember. And then all of a sudden, it's like, hey, here we are, August. So, you know, ready or not. And, you know, August is always a fun time because, you know, of course, kids are thinking back to school, even though they don't want to. They are thinking back to school and back to school shopping and so forth. But it is just amazing how fast the time goes. Well, today's theme or today's focus is something that I have spent many years not only researching, but I have spent interviewing many people. I've spent trying to understand it, trying to heal from it, and trying to help others heal from it as well. And I'm talking about healing intergenerational trauma. And I, just like last week when I had a special attention on the Carlisle Indian Boarding School and the atrocities that went on there, I'm staying with this theme, but I'm going to shift my focus into talking about the mass graves in Ireland. And this was something that I pretty much had stumbled on, and I'll share with you that story here in a bit. But this was something that I wasn't taught in school. This wasn't something that, you know, people around me shared or anybody that I knew really struggled, you know, with this phenomena. I had no idea. And yet it was going on for, you know, decades and decades and decades. Okay. And this is something that I had written about extensively, you know, written about this tragedy and others in my book, When Ancestors Weep. And this is something that, you know, has always been near and dear to my heart, is just how do we heal from the intergenerational trauma? And what is it about intergenerational trauma that seems to just stop people in their tracks, where it's very hard to get out from under? And, you know, most of the time we find tremendous healing from intergenerational trauma by being able to tell our stories, being able to share with one another what has happened to us, or being able to tell stories in a way in which we pass on words of wisdom to one another, or even ways in which, you know, we can find healing. And so we don't pass it on, you know, that we don't pass on the pain and the wounds to generations even yet to be born. And Robert Sutton once said that whenever you dismiss my story, you dismiss who I am. You diminish me. So whenever you dismiss my story, you dismiss who I am, and you diminish me. And storytelling is very, very powerful. We do all come from different perspectives. We do all have different experiences. But how we tell stories, where we tell stories, with whom do we tell stories, and the importance of why we tell stories, all takes into the account of where we have been, where we see, and how we see ourselves, and what hope do we hold out for the future. So if you tuned in last Friday, you remember that I started off with the ancient African proverb that states that it takes a village to raise a child. And this is a very common phrase that's kicked around today, that it's just like, you know, if we want to thank everybody in our life, we realize that, yes, it took a village to teach us and help us and encourage us and so forth. You know, I actually heard it from one of our Olympian athletes, you know, that it certainly takes a village to contribute to the training and the skill of an Olympic champion. And I very much agree with it. You know, it does take a village to raise a child. Or in other words, the survival of any people really extends beyond the immediate family. You know, and this goes way beyond nationality or creed or race, because we are more connected to one another than what we realize. And yet, just as it takes many people to contribute to the development of, say, generations of children, history also has shown us that it also took a village to hide the scandals, the abuses, and the atrocities. So whereas it takes a village to raise a child in a proper way, a very healthy way, a very life-empowering way, it also takes a village to do the complete opposite. Because no one person or entity acts alone. No secret remains hidden, and the truth never stays buried. And that's just something that society, history has never figured out. That people are often killed in order to silence them, or people are often killed and therefore the secret will die with them. And I'm sorry, but the truth just never stays buried, because dead men and dead women and dead children do tell tales of how they died. You know, some died of natural causes, okay, and some died at the hands of others, and some people were not even considered worthy enough to be buried respectfully. But for all of these atrocities and more, it's time for us to begin telling and retelling the stories of how they lived. And not just the telling and a retelling of the stories, but can we understand the messages that are being shared? Can we understand the stories at a different level and perhaps hear what we really need to hear in between the words? Okay, it's time for us to begin telling and really listening to the stories of how people lived. And it's time for all of us to see them for who they are, souls. Souls that lived on after their hearts have stopped beating and their brain waves had ceased and became quiet. Souls that surround us now like a great cloud of witnesses or a communion of saints, if you want to put it into that language. Because our ancestors are speaking to us constantly through the blood that runs through our veins. And yet, how do we reconcile, you know, these events, you know, the history and what's been done, you know, when villages, you know, hide abuses that are going on? And how do we reconcile those with what's happening today? Where do we begin? What questions do we start asking? How do we start telling the stories? Because the real effort behind healing intergenerational trauma from where I sit is, this is important because trauma has the potential to disconnect us from who we are as realizing ourselves as soul. And the reason for this is because trauma places this distorted template over our perceptions. Think about it this way. Trauma says to us, this is all there is. This is all there is to you. This is as good as it gets. Oh, you might be able to heal from this and such, but you'll never forget what happened to you. You will always be haunted by this. You know, all the lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as soul. And yet, once we embrace ourselves as soul, we may be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but also empower others to do the same. But still, as history has tried to teach, you know, many have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul and therefore have tried to silence its cry, which is an impossibility because the power of the soul is powerful and you will never be able to silence the voice of the soul or the cry of the soul. It is that powerful because it's not limited. It's not limited to any time, space, continuum. It is eternal. And that is who we are if we break it down and just, you know, everybody, we are eternal. Okay, but throughout history and the atrocity that we're going to be looking at here, it's just that you know, the people who commit these atrocities, I don't think they ever clue into the fact that they're a soul and the others whom they wound or discredit, they're souls too. So let's take, for example, the mass graves in Ireland. And There is a great article that was written. It was entitled The Forgotten Mass Graves in Ireland. And I believe it was written in January 2018. You could probably Google it and find the entire article yourself. The Forgotten Mass Graves in Ireland. And I just want to read part of that article to you. And the author really makes it a point to say that these are not just isolated incidences. Because when we talk about the mass graves of Ireland, you know, there are many, many, many mass graves. In fact, the author points out that there are over 220 secret mass graves yet to be identified in Ireland, and is now to be led by the Mother Baby Homes Commission of Investigation. Some may take comfort in that, and some don't. I'll just leave that with you. But whenever a Truth and Reconciliation Commission type is organized, it's the results are sometimes questionable because it often becomes very political. Okay, but I'll just leave it at that. But there are over 220 secret mass graves that have yet to be identified, and children and mothers who have yet to be accounted for. And still, today, there are many eyewitnesses and survivors who are alive to talk about the deaths. And many survivors have documented their own testimonies. And many of these same survivors have lost, you know, mothers and brothers and sisters in the shameful places in a predominantly Catholic Ireland. And it's also known that thousands of babies were kidnapped, you know, from the mother and baby homes, and they were sold or transferred to like illegal Catholic Church adoption agencies to often be adopted by, you know, suitable, wealthy, you know, Catholic American families for cash. And I'm not making any of this up. This is well documented. You know, I'm sharing this with you to kind of set the stage for the rest of this broadcast. And according to CHUM historian Catherine Corliss, who I have to admit, very lovely lady who invited me into her own home, and we sat at her kitchen table. And of course, you know, good hospitality, good Irish woman hospitality. She made me a cup of tea. And we sat there and we talked. I told her a little bit of, you know, about my family, and she talked about her family and so forth. But as we were sitting at her kitchen table, she showed me pictures and maps and other physical evidences that there are reports that the babies and the children who died at these homes were buried in, you know, crypt-like chambers. And this is particularly true of the mass grave that was unearthed in CHUM, County Galway, in Ireland. And she said that the investigators had reported that DNA analysis confirmed that the discovered remains were of children, you know, between the ages of 35 weeks and 3 years. And she said to me, and she's quoted in this article, "It's horrific what they did." And again, some people are like, well, that happened a long time ago. Some people are like, it never happened. You're making it up and so forth. But again, as more and more of these reports and eyewitnesses come forward, or, you know, more of the records are, you know, uncovered and, you know, made available to the public, the more we have to question what exactly went on. Okay. So if, again, we take, for example, the mother and baby home in CHUM, County Galway, there were up to 1,000 children and babies that were illegally adopted and trafficked from the home in CHUM, the mother baby home. And I mean, just alone, that's just one place. And this was also reported by the Health Service Executive of Ireland. And these babies were illegally sold into the United States without their mother's consents. And there were, you know, evidence that payments up to about $3,000 for each child that was sent illegally to the United States, well, it went back to the nuns who worked in the mother baby home there in Jume. Okay, so again, we have the health service executive of Ireland documenting all of these. And many, many survivors who are, you know, very much outraged, both men and women, you know, now, you know, have described having been sexually abused or raped or gang raped or witnesses to prostitution at a young age. And they're just made to perform all kinds of sexual acts and so forth at the hands of their adoptive parents in America, or even many clerics who befriended them in the homes. And again, this isn't made up. This is documented. And so I just want to share with you a little bit of my experiences of just how did I get connected to the children's home in Jume, County Galway, in Ireland. Well, I was doing just basic research on intergenerational trauma. And I, you know, as I shared last week, I had started my research and, you know, just understanding, like, what is this going on? I started with the boarding schools here in the United States, the Native American children boarding schools, as well as the industrial schools for, you know, indigenous children in Canada. And so surfing the web one night, just kind of minding my own business, just looking for like whatever I could find related to intergenerational trauma. And I came across this story about a mass grave being discovered at the children's home in Jume, T-U-A-M, Jume, County Galway, in Ireland. And from the experience at the Mohawk Institute, which I believe I talked about, you know, up in Canada, kind of talked about it a couple years ago, I became aware of other crimes against humanity throughout the world in which there was this secret collusion between government and the church, or between the government, the church, and educators, and so on and so forth. And I stumbled across this story of Jume, you know, in County Galway, where there had been a discovery of approximately 800 remains of babies buried in a mass grave. And there were also stories of child abuse and burials that emerged from the mother-child home in Bessborough in County Cork, the very southern end of Ireland. So I, you know, these stories struck me, and I just like, so I contacted the people in Ireland who were and are working to bring about awareness and accountability of these places to, you know, the government and the church at large. And I shared with them how their stories of the mistreatment of women and the abuse of children and the mass burials paralleled Native American Indian experiences with the United States and, as I said, the Canadian industrial boarding schools. And as we talked and as we shared emails, we were both astonished to find that in spite of the striking parallels, neither one of us knew about each other's country's atrocities. I mean, to our amazement, it was almost as if these global crimes against humanity formed this recurring pattern of humanity that was being played out in other places. And so we just kind of left it, you know, as we continued talking, and just left it at like, well, if you're ever in the neighborhood, stop by and see us. Well, that's all I needed to hear. And besides, I was already, you know, feeling the tug on my heart. And so I made it a point to visit Ireland. And I started in Cork, in the southern part of Ireland. And I interviewed several women who were born and raised at the Bessborough mother-child home. And I heard women's stories of punishment and abuses, which appeared to be a daily occurrence in this state religious-run institution. And there had also been reports of collaboration of townsfolks who would often return young runaway mothers back to the home. And, you know, the girls that ran away, you know, these young women, they were easily identified by, you know, the local boarding school uniform that they had to wear. And apparently there was an underlying belief that just ran through communities in Ireland that those girls who became pregnant out of wedlock were sent to these facilities to work off their sins. And as reported by some of the women I interviewed, I mean, the surrounding communities also, you know, sent, you know, their support, perhaps in order to rid society and the church of wayward girls. So as a result, you know, any child born to these mothers, well, they were viewed as illegitimate, and therefore they weren't allowed to be baptized by the church. They just simply were not recognized. Okay. And furthermore, young mothers were then alienated also from their communities as they were forbidden to be churched. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard that term before, but to be churched meant, you know, it was a term that meant, you know, it was the blessing given to new mothers after the recovery of from childbirth in order to receive the sacraments again. And so these young mothers, because they had committed these sins, they were not recognized and were further alienated from their faith communities and maybe even communities in general. They were just not welcomed back. And again, this is the weight of intergenerational trauma. It's like, how do you get out from under what has happened to you in the first place? And then how do you return to society, a society which vows to have raised you, has vowed to educate you, vowed to, we will, you know, take care of you, and only to have that society, that community, turn its back on you and consider you, you know, unredeemable because you've so-called committed some sin. Okay. And, you know, and in addition, you know, since the children born out of wedlock were considered illegitimate, it was just an easy assimilation into the adoption foster care system, you know, right out from under the mother's consent, which then provided a nice income for these institutions. And at the end of listening to these stories, I they asked if I had any questions. And I mean, that was an understatement right there. Of course I had questions. But the one question I had for them was this: where are the men in all of these stories? Where were the boyfriends when these bad girls were shipped off to the homes? And to be quite honest, I wasn't ready to hear their replies, because they looked very, you know, soberly to me, and they just said, you know, not all of these girls ended up pregnant from their boyfriends. Many had been impregnated from their fathers and uncles, even priests. And so to keep them quiet, you shipped them off and made them take the blame for this. And of course, this, you know, adds additional layers of shame, that it was somehow these girls or women's burden to carry the shame or made to feel less than. Well, I would really love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, if you want to call in, please do. That number is 888-627-6008, and I will be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And again, just a word about next week's show. Tune in next Friday afternoon, again, 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time, and any other time in between if you'd like to catch the podcast. Excuse me. And I will continue this conversation on transforming dimensional energy of intergenerational trauma as we take a look at how did we get here and where do we go from here? So how did we get here and where do we go from here? You know, how do we raise the vibrational energy of these lower dimensional atrocities and the pervasive attitudes that still exist today? And how do we raise them to higher levels of dimension where forgiveness and gratitude and love are meant to be embraced and lived out on a daily basis? Because as we move forth, healing, individually, collectively, as a nation and so forth, and countries and all that, it's many people, excuse me, many people want to have these places where the atrocities, were committed as, made into shrines or museums to let's walk through and be reminded what happened here. And then some people are just like, no, let's tear it down. Let's just build something more positive over top of it and any other argument in between. Okay, so we'll take a look at all that as we raise the question, how did we get here and where do we go from here? Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about my own experience of these mother-child homes, mother-children homes, and the abuses that occurred when boarding schools existed back in the day. And these were just, prominent in the 20th century and even late 19th century and the late 1800s. And again, this is not just about a history of once upon a time or, not just about a history that can easily be excused or even justified. Because, as I said, I interviewed several women who were born and raised at the Bessborough Children's Home in County Cork, Ireland. And at the end of listening to their stories, again, I had shared right before the break, the one question I had was, where are these men? Like, where are the boyfriends when these mad, sad, or bad girls were shipped off to the homes or were institutionalized? And as I said, I wasn't ready for what they told me. I had no idea because I was thinking boyfriends, or husbands or something like that. And they just, looked at me and they said, look, these girls that ended up pregnant didn't come from their boyfriends. Some did, okay, but many had been impregnated from their fathers and uncles and priests. And then, of course, came the understanding of, this is why, these girls needed to be shipped off to protect this secret. Because the shame was so bad. But yet these girls, these young women were, made to shoulder that burden, made to carry that shame or made to feel less than as if they were the problem. And I tell you that this perspective and this attitude of women being inferior to men and made to bear the burdens and the shame of society goes all the way back to the misunderstanding of the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. That's for another broadcast. Okay. But, these stories of the Bessborough home and the mass graves being uncovered in Chum, County Galway, really just sparked something in me further about, this is going to stay with us a long, long time. Society is going to be affected. And, that we have yet to even comprehend how long this is going to, damage generations. There's an author, Chenery, C-H-E-N-E-R-Y, Chenery. He had written an article back in 2011, And he actually noted that children and adults who experienced a, shall we say, a prolonged period of chronic victimization, you know, anywhere from months to years, this chronic victimization and total control by others may also experience the following difficulties. Things like an emotional regulation, which, you know, may include persistent sadness or suicidal thoughts or explosive anger or even an inability to express anger. Okay, so he said they are going to have difficulties with emotional regulation. And this is something that in just healthy human development, we all learn to, you know, come to terms with what we're feeling. We all learn that when it's appropriate and how to express, you know, very strong feelings of sadness or anger and so forth like that. But he says that, you know, the children and the mothers who experience this prolonged victimization and just, you know, just as he put it, chronic victimization, really struggled with, you know, consciousness, you know, which includes forgetting traumatic events or even reliving traumatic events. Or even having episodes in which one feels detached from, you know, the mental process of the body, or in other words, dissociation, where you just kind of feel outside of yourself because you just have never been able to connect to yourself. And he says that the mother and the mothers and children will also, you know, have difficulty with self-perception, you know, which could include, you know, just a sense of helplessness. Or struggling with shame and guilt and struggling with stigma, which is a whole nother topic for discussion one day, you know, because stigma comes from society. It comes from communities. It's placed on individuals, almost like that scarlet letter. You know, Hester Prynne, you remember reading that in school? You don't? Okay, well, you have to go back and read it because it is a powerful, powerful story. And you talk about history repeating itself. Stigma does just that. It pretty much slaps a label or some sort of stigmatization on a person, and they can never get out from under it. And it often breeds a tremendous amount of shame in people because they've internalized it. Because the stigma has just been relentless. And I mean, you talk about self-inflicted wounds, you know, in society, it's if society could just wake up and realize how damaging, you know, behaviors and perceptions are to people, you know, that societies will never, ever improve as long as woundedness and stigma and victimization are running rampant. Let alone how people treat children. Okay. Well, Chenery also says that, you know, people who've been years and months and years under chronic victimization have distorted perceptions of the people who were committing the atrocities. And in a way, they just have this sense of kind of attributing this total power over to the perpetrator, or becoming preoccupied with the relationship to the perpetrator, or even preoccupied with revenge. It's like they're constantly caught up in this image, you know, and they just feel so victimized that they never have a chance to, again, heal from that. And then, of course, you know, the last thing that he points out in this chronic, the next to last in this chronic victimization is this, you know, people are going to struggle in their relations with others. And, you know, they're going to isolate. They're going to have a lack of trust, you know, or even this repeated search for, say, a person who can be their rescuer. Okay, and that could lead us down the road of, you know, codependency and other things, and why people, you know, tend to look for love in all the wrong places. Well, in order to heal from what has traumatized them, they might latch on to people whom they perceive as, you can rescue me. Okay, And now, the last thing that Chenery notes is that, you know, people will struggle with, you know, just one system of meanings. In other words, you know, they could have just a loss of faith or a sense of hopelessness and despair. They may not be able to find any joy or meaning and purpose in their lives. Okay, but all of these things are just what he had discovered from just doing his own research, you know, for children and adults who experience this prolonged period of victimization. Okay. Well, I stick to the term intergenerational trauma. And there are certain definitions out there, but the one definition of intergenerational trauma I like the best is this. It's the increasing and often relentless psychological, physiological, spiritual rewounding that, because of a traumatic experience, becomes unconsciously handed down to future generations through distorted distorted perspectives, emotional illnesses, maladaptive behaviors, and codependent relationships. I'll say this again because I think it's worth noting. Okay? My definition of intergenerational trauma is this: the increasing and often relentless psychological, physiological, spiritual rewounding that, because of a traumatic experience, becomes unconsciously handed down to future generations through distorted perspectives, emotional illnesses, maladaptive behaviors, and codependent relationships. And in fact, regardless of the historical context, what makes intergenerational trauma distinct from trauma in general is the fact that the psychological, physiological, spiritual rewounding is often the direct result of premeditated acts of aggression, or premeditated acts of annihilation and or negligence from a person or persons against another person or persons. So these are premeditated acts. These are not accidents, but these are, you know, one person, you know, purposefully does this to another person or persons, okay? And it could include direct and indirect human aggression, you know, against one another, you know, such as, you know, maybe even through oppressive political, socioeconomic, educational, and yes, religious systems. And furthermore, what often adds burning salt, and I mean burning salt, to these intergenerational wounds is the underlying theme of an omission of guilt by offenders. In other words, no system-changing olive branch has ever been extended to heal the wounds afflicted by those who stand guilty. And yet, when attempts are made to acknowledge the past or even offer forgiveness, it's well-intended attempts to kind of assuage the guilt from those associated with crimes or tragedies is often seen as cold and offensive. And this is really the limitation and the danger of, you know, truth and reconciliation commissions. They end up, you know, truth and reconciliation. It's in the name. We want to get to the bottom. We want to get to the truth, and we want to reconcile this. But it often, you know, just digs up old wounds again, and whatever is found or whatever is offered to people to find healing is more like a slap in the face. Or they're just continually throwing salt in those wounds that have never had a chance to heal. And it's often like, well, how can we compensate somebody for what they've been through or their families have been through or something just by throwing money at that? And interesting to keep in mind that whenever somebody wants to start offering money, you know, to you or others, you know, as a form of retribution, you know, think about it this way. They're not offering you money so that you would be satisfied and that you can walk away. They're coming up with a dollar amount and they're offering money so, you know, to give the people so that they can walk away. Okay? That puts it all in a different light. All right. And a lot of what the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have tried to dictate, you know, like, okay, well, those who are the perpetrators and, you know, these state-run or church-run institutions, well, they have to come up with plans to, you know, offer healing and reconciliation to those who have been abused. And that's a violation of international law because, you know, it's almost like, you know, saying to... And saying to the person who has been raped, we're going to sit you down with the person who raped you, and you two are going to work out a plan to, you know, allow you to heal from this. And, you know, your abuser, your rapist, is going to tell you what you can do to heal. And I don't know about you, but I think about these things, and it really makes my blood boil. Because it's just a re-wounding all over again. You know, those who had committed the atrocity should in no way dictate the terms of recovery to anybody that they had wounded. You know, they're going to be part of it, but they cannot dictate how a person can heal. And I'm all for reconciliation. I am all for, restorative justice. Absolutely, restorative justice. But that means sitting down and listening to each other's stories and really understanding what happened in your life that made you think it was okay to wound and hurt people this way and then walk away as if it was no big deal. Okay. So again, you know, when people offer, you know, these well-intended attempts to apologize or something, it may seem as coming off as cold and offensive to people who have been wounded, just because it's more like a, well, we'll just go through the motions here, but in the grand scheme of things, nothing is really going to change. And that reaction shouldn't come as a surprise, because public apologies often divert public attention away from understanding how contemporary policies continue to perpetuate and reinforce oppressive systems. But yeah, you might have individuals doing these things, but, you know, what's the system behind it? What is it about, you know, let's say the government run or religious run or educationally run, programs, situations, agencies, and so forth, that just continue to perpetuate, you know, just very harmful, very hurtful attitudes. Well, as I visited again the people from Bessboro, and walking the grounds of CHUM, I did so with a very strong purpose to, you know, in some way, can we start the healing process? And as I walked these grounds, I really sensed this oppressive burden that hung over these souls, you know, like a huge spider's web, you know. And interesting, I had to look this up because it was bothering me when I did research. But in nature, spiders are able to spin both sticky and non-sticky silk threads. And so by doing so, spiders avoid getting caught in their own web. All the while, their prey are trapped. And it was this image that, you know, came to me. It was an image that is an accurate description of the way individuals feel trapped by a government or a religious system. You know, and once caught in this web of assumptions and prejudices and penalties, the more victims struggled, the more they became entangled. And so with this image in mind, as I was walking, I passed a little memorial garden that was behind one of these mother-child homes. And there were stones that, that marked some of the babies that were buried there, as well as some markers for nuns and others who were also buried there. And to the sides of this garden, there appeared to be other places where the ground had been disturbed, these mounds. And it was reported that unmarked graves of children were there. And as I shared, you know, when times that I visited Bear Butte and I visited other places of where atrocities had occurred, I had always taken tobacco and sage and made prayer ties, and I hung these in the tree, and I sat down and played my Native American flute. And I allowed the sound of the flute to pray for the healing and release of the children and the mothers, you know, whose souls were trapped there in this spider's web. And I also prayed for the release of the adult community who still suffer the effects of being adopted and are unable to connect with their real families. Okay. And I see this pattern over and over again. And, you know, but let us, you know, start from a place of we need to do something to raise the awareness of these stories in order that true healing can occur, in order that people can go on with their lives, that they can find healing, that they can find love and commitment and to live wholly. Well, I am Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I invite you to join me next week, next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to continue this conversation, and we're going to really take a look at the question, how did we get here, and then where do we go from here? So in the meantime, be safe, and may God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.